minutes. Mr. Dublin is seeking post-conviction testing of DNA so he might prove his innocence. Because the trial court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Dublin's motion, this court should reverse and remand with instruction that his motion be granted. Alternatively, this court should remand for a new hearing because the trial judge should have recused herself from hearing Mr. Dublin's motion for the third time. The items that Mr. Dublin seeks to test were items gathered from the scene of the crime, scene of a rape. This included bed sheets, pillowcases, a stuffed animal, underwear, and scissors. The standard we use in evaluating whether Mr. Dublin should get testing of these items for DNA is whether assuming favorable results from these items, would these test results prove his innocence more likely than not?
How would the positive testing of any of them prove and erase the fact that his DNA was inside of her?
It would not erase that fact, but what it would show was that somebody else had been in the bedroom. That evidence connected Mr. Dublin to the victim.
But the rape is based on penetration. It wouldn't show that anyone else had been inside of her.
No, but there would be a reasonable inference if there was DNA found on the bedding, the bed sheets, the pillowcases, that another person had been in.
Someone else occupied that bedroom before her?
There was no evidence about, that I recall, about other people.
So I understand that that was her sister's bedroom before it was hers.
Well, my understanding was that was her bedroom, at least for quite a while. She testified she...
How long is quite a while? And how long does DNA stay on bedding?
Well, Mr. Dublin testified that he had had consensual sex with this woman in a truck. He couldn't recall the exact date that the victim's testimony...
And how is that
testimony
by anything that would be produced by this testing?
This would lend credence to Mr. Dublin's claim that he had, in fact, not been in that bedroom. That's what this evidence would show. And I think it's important for this court to be mindful of what our Supreme Court said in Crumpton, that there will always be strong evidence against a convicted individual, and the court should not focus on the weight or sufficiency of evidence presented at trial to decide a motion for post-conviction DNA testing.
But
so,
we do have to weigh the evidence. That's part of the calculation, is it not?
It is part of the calculation. The calculation is whether a reasonable judge could conclude that this evidence would not show Mr. Dublin innocent of any of these crimes, more likely than not.
In order to assume that there's some sort of positive result, doesn't there have to be some evidence that there is, in fact, DNA evidence from some other suspect on these items? For example, the bear, the underwear, and the scissors? Was there evidence at trial that evidence existed?
These items were not tested. They were gathered by police.
They were taken into evidence. And is there some evidence at trial that these items were touched by some other suspect?
The evidence was that they were touched by the perpetrator.
Yes.
Mr. Dublin's contending he's not the perpetrator.
I understand that. So. But was there some evidence that they were touched by the perpetrator?
Yes, there was evidence. There was testimony from... the police report says that the suspect had his head placed up against the stuffed animal. There's testimony that the suspect was in the victim's bed.
On the bedding, but I'm asking about the underwear, the scissors, and
okay.
The bear.
So the scissors were gathered because there was testimony that the person may have held a knife, and they thought the victim might have thought
and who
scissors.
That?
That comes from the detectives who testified
right.
at trial.
But did the victim testify to
that? The victim did not testify to that because nobody asked the victim those
correct.
Questions.
So there's no evidence that someone mistook scissors for a knife?
There's no testimony from trial. Now, I think
isn't
it's,
that what we look at?
It's what you consider, but I think it's important to recall that Mr. Dublin had no burden to prove himself innocent at trial.
No, but he
has now
a burden
he has
here.
A burden now. So there is a mismatch between looking at the record and what we're deciding now. So you evaluate what is at trial, but you also consider other evidence. The other evidence is
Why don't you answer the other parts of Judge Spearman's question about the underwear and the bear, I think it was.
So the underwear was gathered because the police heard from AB that the suspect had worn this underwear.
And what evidence supported that at trial? Did she testify to that?
She was never asked about that. There was testimony from the detectives who recounted this testimony, and the prosecutor never followed up with a question.
And the only testimony from the victim in this case was that his pants were pulled down just far enough to expose his penis. There was no testimony about...
I would disagree that her testimony was that specific. I think her testimony was that he pulled his pants down, and it was pretty vague.
But no testimony pulled his pants off.
No testimony from AB.
Or anyone else.
I believe that's correct. So
I'm pretty confident that's correct. That makes the underwear kind of a red herring, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't make it a red herring.
I mean, there's absolutely no Mr. evidence. There's a chain of communications between law enforcement officers that gets confused about that underwear. There's no evidence as to the source of that underwear or that connects it to the perpetrator.
You're assuming that there's a confusion about the underwear, but the state never asked those detectives about the confusion. So the state should have asked, and they could have clarified that at trial.
The only evidence we have about the clothing is from the victim, and she doesn't have him removing it.
I would disagree. I think the record shows a reasonable inference that he removed his pants
so
and therefore his underwear.
If we disagree with you on that point, then we would disagree with you about the need for testing of the underwear?
I think regardless of the underwear, Mr. Dublin is at least entitled to testing of the bedding, of the bed sheets and the pillowcases and the bear.
That doesn't answer my question, does it, counsel? My question is, if we disagree with you about the underwear, can we exclude it if we accepted the rest of your argument?
I'm unfamiliar with the trial court denying certain items rather than all of the items. I know it's the items come back and you receive testing, maybe the trial court can say testing is no longer warranted. But
so is it most your view it's an all or nothing proposition?
You know, I think the trial court probably would have some discretion on what items to be tested. In this court, the court absolutely refused to deny testing in all cases. And this court's job is not sitting in de novo review. It's whether the trial court acted reasonably in evaluating all the evidence. And I would like to briefly talk about the appearance of fairness. So even if you disagree that Mr. Dublin is not entitled to DNA testing, this court should remand for a new hearing because this judge was hearing this motion for the third time. The trial judge, this court reversed once, it remanded. That judge, without notice or opportunity for Mr. Dublin to be heard, denied the motion again before the mandate was final, and Mr. Dublin was entitled to a new judge.
All right, thank you. You have 2 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ann Summers on behalf of the state of Washington. This court should affirm the trial court's denial of the motion for post-conviction DNA testing. While it's true that in evaluating these motions, the court must presume that the test results from the DNA testing would be favorable, the court does not view all reasonable inferences in favor of the defense, which is basically what Dublin is asking this court to do. This court cannot disregard the fact that the DNA mat, Dublin's DNA, was found in the vaginal, anal, breast, and neck swabs from the victim, and that the victim testified, and the jury found her credible, that she had no relationship with Mr. Dublin at all, let alone a consensual sexual relationship. The evidence from the evidence from the rape kit is obviously the most probative piece of evidence as to guilt, far more probative than any items from the victim's room that may or may not have been touched by the rapist. There was no testimony that there was semen on the bedding, and there's no testimony establishing that this underwear was, in fact, the rapist. And I'll go through the evidence here because it seems to be, because I think it's important. Now, what happened at trial was the defense tried to take advantage of some confusion by Detective Manley.
The rape took place in the bed, right?
Yes.
So we would assume that the perpetrator left some DNA somewhere in the bedding.
You may or may not, it's possible he didn't.
Semen, it could be off his skin.
Yes, that's true. But we already have the DNA match on the vaginal swab. So this is like Gentry. in that, you know, once the victim's DNA is found on the defendant's shoelace in Gentry, that sort of closes the case. And what the Supreme Court said, once you have that, the fact that someone else's hairs might be on the victim's body is not going to rebut her blood on Gentry's shoelace. So the same way here,
well,
just because
we look at the, I guess the defendant's theory of the case, that he had consensual sex with her in a truck earlier that same day, then the she goes to bed, the perpetrator of the rape comes in using a condom, has sex with her. Why would that not suggest that, I mean, if we accept that scenario, that there's we would have some evidence of another perpetrator who could have committed the crime?
Well, my argument is you cannot accept that scenario. That goes to, see, you're drawing all reasonable inferences from the evidence in favor of the defense here. This is not a, request for a lesser included instruction, or that doesn't happen here. The trial court is allowed to take the evidence as it came in the trial and to accept the jury's determination. Now, you have the victim testifying that she had no relationship with Dublin at all. She didn't even know him. So I don't think the statute, which places a heavy burden on defendants to get this testing, rightly so, because it is a significant resource question, doesn't say, hey, we have to accept the defendant's defense, even though it was rejected by the jury. And that's basically what you'd have to do here to accept that this would be probative at all in light of the DNA results from the rape kit.
There's now, no request to test his pickup truck, is there?
No, the pickup truck's not in evidence.
Actually,
so
the presence of her DNA in the pickup truck would be probably the most probative of him not being guilty of any DNA testing that was not available at trial that could become available in the future.
Yeah, the pickup truck, I'm sure, is long gone.
Well, this is Vashon Island. It might not.
Now, Detective Manley testified that she collected the gray underwear because, quote, she was told by Detective Gordon.
What about the issue with Judge Madow and whether or not she should have recused herself?
Okay. Yeah, I think you have to realize this was a pro se motion that came from Mr. Dublin from prison, so there was never going to be any hearing. The motion was filed by Mr. Dublin. There was a miscommunication between me and the bailiff as to when the state's response was due. So Judge Middow, who had been the trial judge and who was probably far more familiar with the evidence than I was, denied the motion before the state filed the response. That went up on appeal. This court felt that her order did not properly reflect the favorable presumption, that she had applied the favorable presumption, so remanded. And again, there was no reason to think that counsel was going to be appointed. I actually don't know how counsel got appointed for this motion. It's not the sort of thing for which counsel is authorized under the rules or statutes. 30 days after this court's decision, Judge Middaugh entered a new order making clear that she had employed the favorable presumption but still did not feel that this evidence would be probative of innocence.
Wasn't it before the mandate issue?
Well, the mandate should have issued on the 30th day and did not. So her order was on the 30th day. I presume she was assuming the mandate was going to come in that day. And I think she was just being diligent to make sure sometimes these things kind of get lost and judges never act on them. So
she denied it once. She denied it again.
Mm-hmm.
She vacated that order when she was advised that she entered it before the mandate. And then she denied it again. Why would not a reasonable person think, well, she denied it once, she denied it twice, I don't really have a good shot next time up?
Well, no, because she's viewing that, because she knows all the evidence. But there's no, this isn't like Solas Diaz, where she's making comments that make it look like she won't properly apply the law. And she did not deny, this court didn't find that she had improperly evaluated the evidence. I mean, the remand was basically to make sure she had employed the favorable presumption. And once she said, you know, once she, it was more of a mechanical problem or a formalistic problem with her order and not having the favorable presumption clear on the face of her order.
We just didn't have a clear enough record to know what test she'd used.
Yes, exactly. So it's not as if this court said her first ruling was an abuse of discretion, right? It's just that you weren't sure she had properly employed the standard. So it gets sent back to her. She says, yes, I am employing that standard. So there's no reason to think that she wasn't fair. There's no, I mean, I think this appellate courts have rightly been very reluctant to order reassignment simply because a judge made an error of law somewhere along the way, which is basically what happened here at most. I'm not sure it was even an error of law by Judge Middow. It was just simply an omission from the order making the presumption and the standard explicit. I just want to say that also on AB's testimony, as of some question, this is on 592 of the record, the prosecutor asked her, at any point did he take his clothes off? And she answered, he unzipped his pants and pulled them down far enough that his penis was exposed. Now, the defense astutely asked no questions whatsoever of Detective Gordon about the source of this underwear. And the cross-examination of AB was, frankly, 4 pages long. And the defense didn't ask her anything about the underwear. So the defense was clearly trying to take advantage of some miscommunication among the law enforcement officers, put that out there as kind of a red herring, as you said, at the trial. It certainly did not follow up with the two witnesses who could have said, could have drawn a connection between this underwear and the rapist. So there's really evidence in trial does not support that this underwear was at all connected to the rapist. So if you employ the favorable presumption and even assume, as you said with the bedding, that the defendant's DNA is either not going to be on the bedding or someone else's DNA is going to be on the bedding, that doesn't raise a reasonable probability of innocence here, given that the defendant's DNA is in the most probative pieces of evidence, and that's the swabs from the rape kit. I mean, lots of people could have touched or been on the victim's bed. If the court has no further questions, we ask that you affirm.
Thank you.
The state is incorrect on its recitation of the facts. Judge Middow issued her opinion 29 days after this court's opinion, not 30 days. That was before the mandate was issued. Mandates are regularly issued after 30 days, not exactly on the 30 days. As to how counsel got appointed, I noticed that the judge had entered an order before the mandate had issued, and I got Mr. Dublin counsel, and Mr. Dublin is entitled to counsel under the statute if he requests it. And the focus on whether Judge Middow should have recused herself is based on her making a second decision in judging the motion on the merits, saying, I'm applying the proper standard. Mr. Dublin, you lose. That's what she did. Now, can she now fairly adjudicate the same issue again after firmly expressing her view on that point? The answer is no. And that
did she take a subsequent briefing after vacating her?
She did not. If you look at her order, she just says, I've looked at the previous briefing.
She didn't allow any additional briefing?
Well, after the motion was vacated, she did allow more briefing.
Okay. And is there some indication that she considered it or that she failed to consider that additional briefing?
I think she considered the additional briefing afterward.
And if she did consider the additional briefing, why is it that she didn't receive a fair hearing?
Well, Mr. Dublin did not receive a fair hearing because a reasonable, disinterested observer would question her ability to adjudicate the matter afresh for the third time. And that's similar to what happened in the Supreme Court's opinion in Solis Diaz, where the sentencing court...
There were other indications other than the fact that the judge had reached a similar decision before. I mean, the judge made a number of comments that suggested that...
Yeah. And had there been a hearing in this case, we might have comments from the judge saying the same thing. We don't have a hearing.
Did anyone request a hearing?
The mandate hadn't issued, so Mr. Dublin hadn't even had an attorney an opportunity to request a hearing yet. The judge issued this order before.
But there was no request for a hearing.
Even
when he had counsel, there was no request for a hearing.
I believe there was a request not for oral argument on his motion when he had counsel later on. I'd ask this court to grant Mr. Dublin's motion or a testing or remand for a new hearing before a different judge.
All right. Thank you.